I don't know what's real. I don't know what's not real.
Limited Capacity is a collection of six darkly amusing stories about the mysterious ways we interact with the internet and with each other.
There's something going on with him. It's like an act. I don't trust him.
What?
You're staring at me like I should say something, but I don't really know what to do here.
That's the whole name of the game. Don't talk about how the town isn't real. Do you understand?
Limited Capacity. Available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
I got a question for, well, I got a question for two of you for sure. One of you maybe. Do you guys get boners when you wake up?
Yeah. Oh,
yeah. Lauren?
I mean, I got good tea, so yeah.
I'm glad you didn't assume.
I did not assume.
I don't wake up with boners.
You didn't get a boner? Okay, well, actually, so I think it was probably safe to assume that Brian and Taylor, you get boners when you wake up. I get boners.
That's pretty normal, right?
Yeah, I think it's pretty normal. It's like the term morning wood. And I think I'm not exactly sure of the science behind it. If you are a physician or you're someone who knows something about anything, send us a letter.
Letters specifically
sickboypodcast.com if you know the science behind morning boners. But I think it's something to do with, like, you wake up, the blood flow, I guess, in your body,
it's just been pooling.
Yeah, right. It's been pooling. It's now starting
pooling
to move
in your dick all night.
And then it moves. No, it wouldn't be pooling in your dick. It's pooling elsewhere. And then you wake up and then
it's pooling.
And then it goes to your penis, because that's what a boner is. It's
real fast. So fast. It happens so fast.
Yeah. And so that's, I think, you know, I guess that's how morning boners work. I really don't know. But Lauren,
why don't you give me your why don't you let us know, like, your best theory on why
my best theory is that you know what, I really have no idea. I don't know.
I'm sure I have
you
an could, idea.
Yeah. What? Let's
hear it.
Please, woman, explain this to me, Lauren. Of why I get boners in the morning.
Because it's your dick, like, pointing you out of the bed. It's like your dick's like, okay, time to go.
Yeah, time to get up.
That could very well.
I actually get up.
If
I was. If I was going to guess, I would say that it's like an energy storage thing. So you're fully replenished. And so, like, you have so much energy just, like, running through your body. It's ready to go and get the day started that, like, it just, like, part of it is in your dick.
We're,
you know,
so,
you
so,
carry, like, right, a little bit of energy right in the right tip of your penis.
So if you,
and it's like,
right.
I guess,
so if you,
I guess,
don't have a boner in the morning, it's like, stay in bed. You're like, if you don't have, right, a boner when, yeah, you wake up, it's like, sleep longer.
You're not fully charged. Yeah. It's an indicator, right, that you're fully charged.
This is really dumb. I don't know why we naturally, a lot of people with penises naturally get boners when they wake up. I do know that if you have a hard time getting boners when it's like make fuck time, and you also don't typically get boners in your morning wood, that it's a sign that you have erectile dysfunction that is not just psychosomatic erectile dysfunction, but it's like actual
testosterone.
It's actual, like, there's physical.
I know that there's a link to testosterone levels and morning wood.
Yeah.
There's a link there.
I feel like this is definitely tying back to the battery just not being fully charged. Then I think I was right.
Well, there's a reason why I brought this up, but before I do, Lauren, you don't get like clit boners when you wake up or anything like that?
No, not that I've noticed. I don't get morning boners. I give morning boners.
Heyo.
Oh, wow.
Nice.
Dude, fuck yeah,
nice,
dude.
Don't tell us that.
If we were in the same room, I would bones you.
This is inappropriate.
Right.
Wait, what did you say, Taylor? What did you just
give her bones?
I said I'd bones you.
You, Jesus, dude, You can't, you know, like I can't perplexed. Bone our the person
no,
we
I would,
hired.
No, no, no.
Guys,
I would bone. I'd
dude,
bo- I'd
Kyla, I can
you.
See Kyla right behind you.
Yeah, I was gonna say that's very bold. Yeah. We could literally
yeah, but,
see her.
Yeah, but she doesn't even know. But she can't hear the other side of this conversation, so she doesn't even know that I'm talking to Lauren.
Oh wow.
Oh okay. As if this isn't going to be released to thousands of people tomorrow. That
oh
could
God.
Fucking
damn
tell
it.
Her.
I completely God. Forgot about that.
This is so inappropriate. So here's the reason why I brought this up. I know that. I know that Taylor and Brian, I know you guys have like have been in like sort of high altitude areas in the world. I've also been to higher altitude areas in the world. There's a phenomenon that I came across that is pretty fascinating. Climbing Mount Everest gives people boners. So,
dude, I could have told you that for sure. Like, have you... I just think about how excited I would be to be there. And just the whole time I would be walking around with a raging heart on like, oh. I can't wait to get to the top of this hill.
Well,
like excitement.
I've
pure
got
excitement,
a theory
right?
forming in my head as to why this is already.
It has nothing to do with excitement. It has to do with blood pressure.
Oxygen.
Blood pressure. Mm-hmm. Climbing Mount Everest is reserved for the... This is an article from... gentside.co.uk, and they're pulling this from Vice somewhere. This is just trickle down internet. This is by Kim Scott. Climbing Mount Everest is reserved for the elite. It requires months of preparation and a lot of money. But once you've succeeded, you would have the satisfaction of being at the highest point on Earth with an extra bonus. It might sound like a dirty joke, but it is actually a thing. According to Srinath Varma, a passionate 26-year-old climber, The entire blood flow slows down as you get higher on the mountain, and the heart beats harder and faster. Quote, the lack of blood flow to your brain paired with oxygen deficiency really does make your mind go blank. You feel as though you have no retained knowledge, and you start to forget how your body works. It's scary. When asked if he got a boner, he answered that he gets one after 4,500 meters. This phenomenon is not isolated, and it has a name, the airplane boner.
Oh, I mean,
yeah,
I get airplane makes... boners like it's fucking going out of style.
Well,
the airplane,
that immediately made sense.
The airplane boner thing is a bit different, too, I think. So, or I guess maybe not. As the cabin pressure changes with altitude, the male penis becomes erect. Yeah, right. The lower the cabin pressure due to altitude, then causes blood to flow directly to the boner region.
Same thing.
Dude, if I'm going to fall asleep on a plane...
Same thing I said earlier. It's because you're just so excited for your trip. Like, have you guys ever gone to Cancun? And like, you just have a raging heart on the entire time. Yeah. But then when you come back, you don't. It's crazy.
Did I tell you guys about the time that I flew back from Mexico and we flew out of Cancun? I didn't go to Cancun, but I was flying out of Cancun. And the guy that sat in front of me, he was like this... He was doing cocaine. No. He had done probably
doing cocaine off his rock.
Way
heart,
too much cocaine. and he was
that's a crazy
he was
visual.
Sitting in front of me. He was probably like 60, like 55 to 60, or maybe he was like 40, but just partied so hard he looked 60. And this guy was he was such a hurting unit. He puked the entire flight back to Canada. He filled bag upon bag. This guy was not doing all right. Mexico did not treat him well. Anyway,
dude, when I'm on a plane, I'm like, do you guys do this? I sit there. I mean, you know, I fly a lot, or I used to fly a lot, and I will lay down. I will sit there, and I'm like, okay, I can tell that sleep is coming on. You know, I watch my movie or whatever, and now I'm going to take a nap, and I'll go, oh, I need a sweater. I need a sweater
or some type of
material or my laptop or something. And I got to put it over my lap because 100% while I'm sleeping, I'm going to get rock solid.
Definitely.
And I don't want, you know, Karen sitting next to me to, you know,
call the police on your boner.
Yeah. Call the police on my boner and take offense to my unintentional boner.
Yeah.
And because I'm looking at Karen going, yo, this isn't for you. This is just me sleeping. It's not my fault. I didn't do anything. Dude, I didn't ask for this.
You are literally repeating verbatim a Theo Von bit about him getting a boner on a plane and telling the lady next to him, who is angry at his boner, that his boner is for him and not for her.
Yeah, it's for me. This is for me. This ain't for you.
I had this thought to talk about this article this morning because I woke up with Morning Wood this morning and I was thinking about how like, man, I don't know how, like, boners are so they're so interesting to me because it's like they can come on out of nowhere, and sometimes they just like they can be so. They can be so intense in pressure and feeling. And there's like this thing sometimes that happens, especially with the morning ones, where it's like they just, it feels like they're never going to go away. Like there's almost like a, not a worry, but like sort of like a slight like, ooh, is this like a, is it called a priapism or priapism? Like where you're kind of like,
I think it's because you've had it forever. You've had it for like 2 hours in bed.
Really? Is that how morning wood works? Like, I don't think you do. I think you get it. Like,
well, I don't know how long, but I wake up and it's very already there.
Yeah, I think you
it's
get
not
it.
Like I wake up and then it comes.
I think
on.
You get it as you're coming out of REM. I think you're like coming out of sleep and you're starting to get it,
dude. It's totally your battery is recharged. The light ticks on and you're good to go. Like it's, Lauren was saying it too. It just directs you. It pulls you right out of bed. And I think it's like that indicator that like, hey, the world is ready for you.
And the world you is are ready for the world.
Yeah, the world is ready for this.
later in the conversation, we speak to a clinical psychologist who works for Movember. We're going to be talking about men's health. And hey, what a great way to start the conversation by talking about some male anatomy and boners. Let's move on to something a little more scientific and a little more interesting. This is
debatable.
Super fucking mind-blowing. Okay, this is coming out of MIT MIT News from Jennifer Chu. This is the title of the article: artificial intelligence model detects asymptomatic COVID-19 infections through cell phone recorded coughs. Results might provide a convenient screening tool for people who may not suspect they are infected. So here's the sort of highlights from this article. It's a bit of a lengthy one. But basically, this is what I pulled out.
Are you saying that Big Brother is listening to us all the time?
No, but I mean, well, yes. I mean, did you not watch that fucking documentary that came out that everybody watched, The Social Dilemma?
Yes, you know, yes, that's right. I've seen Black Mirror.
The triplet robots that are inside our phones, like trying to send us fucking notifications every 10 minutes.
I mean, who hasn't gotten Instagram ads about things that they've literally just been talking about only 30 seconds later, right? Dude, I'm telling you.
I've been getting IG ads on things I've been thinking about. Anyway, that's for, I have.
Whoa,
I have. And that's
dude.
For another, that's for
Elon
another.
Musk is in your head, dude.
I have. And that's
Neural net.
I have been. And we can talk about that another time. This is what this article basically says. So this team at MIT, they used the 2,500 COVID-associated recordings. So they were collecting this data, along with 2,500 more recordings that they randomly selected from the collection to balance the data set. They used 4,000 of these samples to train the AI model. The remaining 1,000 recordings were then fed into the model to see if it could accurately discern coughs from COVID patients versus healthy individuals. So they have recorded coughs from a ton of these people, and they've trained the AI with a total of 5,000 recordings, and they took then 1,000 of the recordings, and they tested it through the AI, right? So the model identified 98.5% of coughs from people confirmed with COVID-19. And of those, it accurately detected every single one of the asymptomatic coughs.
What?
The team is working on incorporating the model into a user-friendly app, which, if FDA approved and adopted on a large scale, could potentially be a free, convenient, non-invasive pre-screening tool to identify people who are likely to be asymptomatic for COVID-19. A user could log in daily, cough into their phone, and instantly get information on whether they might be infected and therefore should confirm with a formal test.
Well, but a cough into your phone is not the same as a genuine.
No, but
like I need to cough.
The whole idea here is that you're coughing into your phone and the AI is so dialed in that it is able to detect the sounds in your cough to say with 98.5% accuracy whether or not you have COVID-19. And pretty much
better than
the
nose swab test?
Pretty much with 100% accuracy whether or not you are asymptomatic with COVID-19. Is that enough?
That's crazy.
That is super mind blowing. You know what it makes me think of all the effort and the technology and the science that is going into researching COVID and COVID related things and things for detecting COVID and all this shit. Mm. And how many people, like what happens? How bummed are people going to be if there's a vaccine that just gets sent out and they're like, oh, all this technology that we developed is now worthless.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? Like
pretty bummed.
You spend so much time developing something and you know, you're developing it for the health of the world, but you're also thinking, you know, this might punch my ticket to Richville. And
well, when,
no, go, go
say,
ahead.
Well,
but then it all falls away.
Yeah, well, when there's a vaccine, it's still going to spread. Like once it's announced that there's a vaccine that works, it'll have to be produced on a massive scale. It'll have to be distributed and all that's still going to, it's going to take a lot of time. So if we're able to implement an app quicker than that, then we'll be able to bring the disease to heal and be able to live normally. Like imagine if everyone was able to live the way we have been here in the Atlantic bubble up till now, like knock on wood. Like mm-hmm. having mm-hmm. contact tracing that sophisticated might enable people in other parts of the world to be living the dream like we've been and save lives that. Between now and then.
Yeah. I mean, when is the vaccine coming out? I mean, I heard from one particular source that it was supposed to be available already.
Dude, who knows?
Dude, we're going to find it. We're going to get the vaccine before we find out who's president.
No, come on. Well,
it's going to take a while to find out who's president, though.
Hold on, let me refresh my CNN link. See if it's over.
Yo,
have you guys heard of GPT-3?
No, what's that?
You told me it's an AI thing. You sent me some stuff on it, a video on it before of how crazy advanced it is.
Yeah, it's basically like AI that uses deep learning to produce human-like text. So like you could basically get a human to it ingests a bunch of information and then it starts to like create text that sounds like the text that was input into it. And you can start getting it to like training it to answer questions. And it's basically going to be like the language source for AI. So it can start talking in like really intellectual ways and interacting and interfacing with human beings.
Well, have you ever heard the audio of two AIs speaking to each other that they developed their own language? So they took two AIs and they got them to try to communicate and they started to develop their own language with one another. And it's very eerie to listen to because it sounds like a glitching out fucking computer that's trying to talk, but they're talking back and forth to one another. It's very trippy.
That's the last thing
the last human being is going to hear.
Oh fuck yeah, dude! Yes, yeah.
Guys, how dark and ominous is the word deep learning?
Yeah,
deep learning.
Super dark
deep learning
and ominous.
Just makes me think like, just think of a computer that's just sitting in a corner and it's like the camera's on it and you just see the light flashing and it flashes a little bit quicker.
Hey man, listen,
the camera is just zooming in slowly. And then you realize that that thing is going to kill everybody.
Halloween.
No, that's literally running everything.
Look, Halloween is over. We are in November. We're ramping up for Christmas. Okay. We're trying to keep things light, trying to keep things sweet. Okay. I want to keep it on this AI train, but I want to lighten it up a bit. I just went through this article a little further and I just found something that I didn't see prior. And this is going to blow your fucking minds. Okay, so talking about AI and the and how impressive AI can be, right? Prior to the pandemic's, this is from the same MIT article, prior to the pandemic's onset, research groups had already begun training algorithms on cell phone recordings of coughs to accurately diagnose conditions such as pneumonia and asthma. Get this. In similar fashion, the MIT team was developing AI models to analyze forced cough recordings to see if they could detect signs of Alzheimer's, a disease associated with not only memory decline, but also neuromuscular degradation, such as weakened vocal cords. So they were working on figuring out AI to potentially diagnose Alzheimer's through the sound of a cough. They first trained a general machine learning algorithm or neural network known as ResNet 50. Fuck, that's a spooky name. To discern, discriminate sounds associated with different degrees of vocal cord strength. Studies have shown that the quality of the sound can be an indication of how weak or strong a person's vocal cords are. Subriana, this is one of the people, trained a neural network on an audiobook data set with more than 1,000 hours of speech to pick out the word them from other words like the and then. The team trained a second neural network to distinguish emotional states evident in speech, because Alzheimer's patients and people with neurological decline more generally have been shown to display certain sentiments such as frustration or having a flat affect more frequently than they express happiness or calm. The researchers developed a sentiment speech classifier model by training it on a large data set of actors intonating emotional states such as neutral, calm, happy, and sad. The researchers then trained a third neural network on a database of coughs in order to discern changes in lung and respiratory performance. Finally, the team combined all three models and overlaid an algorithm to detect muscular degradation. The algorithm does so by essentially simulating an audio mask or a layer of noise and distinguishing strong coughs, those that can be heard over the noise, over weaker ones. With their new AI framework, the team fed in audio recordings, including of Alzheimer's patients, and found it could identify Alzheimer's samples better than the existing models. The results showed that together, vocal cord strength, sentiment, lung and respiratory performance, and muscular degradation were effective biomarkers for diagnosing the disease. That is
that's pretty nuts.
Wild. That is so fucking mind blowing.
Wow. It's like crazy. A cough is like the fingerprint sound for the human health or something. That's incredible. Yeah. That they're able to diagnose such a range of problems.
Just through the sound of a cough.
I can't get over that. Yeah, and a forced one at that, Tay, because that's one thing that I kind of thought. I was like, well, it's going to be a forced cough if you're feeling fine, which most of the time, unless you're Jeremy, you are. That's true. You're like not coughing.
Yeah, that's true.
Tee
yeah,
hee, little that. Pot shot. That's but
yeah. So what did we learn? We learned this year through AI that it's possible to diagnose something like Alzheimer's through a cough, and also that our and this was from a live show that we did recently, that our buttholes, our anuses, our anus is a biomarker, anus. Is a an identifiable biomarker as unique as your fingerprint.
Mm-hmm. Your butt finger.
So lots to
it's
learn.
It's really interesting what scientists have been up to lately, isn't it?
It really is. I mean, there's this, yeah. There's the butthole thing, and then there's boners at the top of Mount Everest.
Crazy.
Wow. What a great collection of learnings this Friday.
Yeah. Lots to take home, you know? So anyway, that's fucking crazy. Also, it's like it kind of blows my mind about, like, you know, I don't know. I'm just such a fucking idiot. You know, like I sit here and I think about AI. The last thing I would have ever thought, like, how did they get to that point where they go, hey, let's take these like three things that seem completely separate from one another and then see if we can pull them together and then train a computer to basically tell us something that like it really is. It's so sci-fi that it's like hard for me to wrap my head around. You know, it's so Westworld. Like it's so,
I mean, that's basically what we just did with all the computer deep learning stuff. We took boners. Yeah. We took AI. Yeah. Okay. Like we took all these things and now out of that comes a deeper understanding of human health, the capacities of computers, and how we live our lives as humans.
So crazy.
I mean, we're basically the AI.
Yeah.
It's crazy how much but it's crazy how much data we produce as like an online tech based species that we're communicating constantly through mediums that are able to be tracked and then analyzed and then reported on. And like there was an episode of Reply All that came out last week or the week before where they were talking about the global happiness calculator and how they're tracking the happiness of everybody on the planet through Twitter.
Oh, that's cool.
and basically
It was through like words that were
used? It's a sentiment analysis. Right.
And emojis.
Right.
Yeah.
Twitter analyzes emojis too.
That's right.
Yeah. So
how do they account for everybody on Twitter being massively dysfunctional people?
Well, yeah, so I guess it's basically only they can only really make statements about people who use Twitter, I guess, right? But Alex Goldman, one of the hosts, gave access to this company to track his personal text messages over the past year. And they went and did a data dump of all of the messages that he sent and analyzed his happiness. And they were like, yeah, it looks like you were going through a tough time in like September of this year. And tell us about this time of the month. Like, what were you experiencing? And he went into like the details of like why he would have been feeling that way. Mm. But it's crazy how machines can start to know more than I mean, in a lot of cases, know a lot more about us than we know about ourselves.
That's the thing with AI, man. Once we hit the singularity, and that thing starts teaching itself at a rate that like we can't even comprehend, and it's just compounding like second after second.
I mean that's why I host this podcast, because I want there to be enough data of who I was and how I think as a person, so that when I'm about to die, they can just capture that and bring me back to life as some piece of the neural network.
An episode of Black Mirror.
Yeah, actually, it was
literally an episode.
I'm compositing the artificial intelligence version of myself through this podcast. All of us.
Yeah, we'll never have to be without you, Brian.
God.
It's really great if we brought back like in the Black Mirror episode where they compile the like AI version of Domhnall Gleeson's character through his social media personality, we would just get a version of Brian that's always on the beach in Hawaii in a van.
Dude, that is the best version of myself.
It would just be Brian at the beach
constantly
with van problems,
constantly constantly working on his next talk. So hey, we got a really sweet letter. Last week we had the pleasure of releasing our episodes all about the wonders and the beauty of psilocybin as used as a therapy for specifically some patients here in Canada who are dealing with end of life distress. By the way, just throwing this out there, and we can talk about this next week, but Oregon has officially voted in.
That's right.
They decriminalized all drugs in Oregon. crazy yeah. step
yeah in small right amounts
direction, I think in small amounts yeah so anyway after we put out those episodes, which were amazing, Dr. O'Sullivan and Thomas Hartle, if you haven't listened to him, I highly suggest you go check it out. We got a letter from a listener. Someone actually listened to us and wrote in to letters@sickboypodcast.com. you can send a letter there if you have a comment or a question or you want something read on the show. And this comes from Kira. I'm going to read this to you guys if you haven't read it yet. Just finished listening to the episodes with Dr. Sullivan and Dr. O'Sullivan and Thomas Hartle. Okay, Kira, you know what? I'm sorry. I got to call you out here. You said Dr. Sullivan and Thomas Hartley. Close, but no. Dr. O'Sullivan and Thomas Hartle on psychedelic therapy. I'm just.
Yeah, if you write us a letter, make sure you don't spell anything wrong or we're going to call you out on the podcast.
You can also send your letters to, whatever. That's fucking, guys, my back hurts too much. Let's get this over with. They were fascinating. It's so exciting to hear about the benefits of these treatments. I thought you might be interested to know that psychedelics, ketamine at least, are also being tested for chronic pain treatment. My dad's lived with a mess of chronic pain issues for the last 23 years. Oof. It took him 10 years to get diagnosed, and the diagnoses were complex. Fibromyalgia, peripheral neuropathy, spondyloarthritis, 2 disintegrated discs in his spine. I'm pretty sure I'm forgetting some of it. The pain had gotten progressively worse over the years. His day-to-day treatment includes high doses of prescription opioids. Eesh. He's also a patient at a specialist pain clinic in Vancouver. He goes down every year or two to have his facet nerves burned down so they are less sensitive to the pain. Oh my Lord. About five years ago, he signed up for an experimental ketamine treatment with the clinic. They admitted him for 2 or 3 weeks, throughout which he was kept on a ketamine drip. He described the dose as being just at the starting point of a high, not deep into a trip. The goal was to reroute the pathway of the pain signals. Pain travels to the brain through the nerves, and with chronic pain, it's taking the same route over and over and over again. Over time, those pathways get deeper, making the pain more intense. The ketamine treatment breaks those paths, forcing the pain to find a new route. That's my unscientific understanding of it. That's Kira, and she's not a doctor. Just take it easy.
Yeah, that's right, you folks? Saying it factually. We get it, Jared.
Take it easy, folks.
Yep.
For Dad, the treatment was a huge success. He was able to cut his opioid dose in half. Unfortunately, the treatment is temporary. The new pathways get deeply embedded over time. He'd likely do the treatment again, but the clinic has had their funding cut and have less than half the beds they used to. He's even having a hard time getting his facet treatment done on time. Through it all, it's his incredibly strong spirit that gets him through. He rarely leaves the house anymore, but finds so much joy in the little things. Watching birds and squirrels at his bird feeder. Spoiling my niece and nephew. Traveling the world through Google Earth. Fuck yeah, that's super fun. He's a joker who loves to laugh. He's got a huge heart and isn't afraid to show his emotions. I told him he should apply for the show, but I think it might be hard for him. He does not have much energy these days. Anyway, thanks for having these conversations. There's potentially so many amazing benefits to psychedelic therapy. The work you're doing to break down the stigma is important. Well, thanks for that, Kira. Ketamine treatments. I've heard a number of conversations about ketamine being used for especially for treatment resistant chronic depression. And again, it ties into that whole rewiring of the neural pathways in the brain and mm-hmm. kind of like changing up those pathways.
Oh, that's crazy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's ketamine. There's MDMA is really big.
Yeah. MDMA is being used big time for PTSD specifically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's right.
So yeah. I think we're probably a while out, but like Dr. O'Sullivan said, MDMA is probably going to be the next thing that we see become legalized and used for therapy use. This stuff that's happening in Oregon right now is fucking huge. I think that not only did they decriminalize all drugs, but they also passed a law where the use of psilocybin for therapy is legal now in Oregon, which is again huge. Oh, so, cool. There was a number of states that like legalized cannabis, So it's like the wheels are slowly turning.
Yeah. It's so good for like overall public health for those drugs to be decriminalized too, because mm-hmm. it's not only like the incarceration rates go down, but then it allows drugs like that to be studied for medicinal purposes. So
I'm
it like
sure,
opens the doors to so many future treatments.
I'm sure Mark Tindall was pretty stoked to see Oregon pass that law.
Yeah, yeah. And like once one state or one country takes that step, then it makes it easier for the next country to, and like things start to happen at a faster rate. But but at the same time, I would say that isn't necessarily true in the sense that like federally Canada has legalized cannabis, but in the states they took the first steps, at least in North America anyway. Legalizing it in certain states, but then there's no federal law, and like states, like I was surprised to hear the other night that a couple nights ago when the election was on, like when it was like, you know, 1,000 miles an hour election coverage, that New York hadn't legalized cannabis yet, and that was really surprising to me.
Yeah, well, I mean, we were there last year, right? And I remember you guys were looking for joints. And like they were like, no, we don't. But they were like selling CBD pre-rolls, but they didn't.
Yeah,
have
they
THC.
Were like CBD stores, and they sold joints and oils and all that stuff, right?
But it's wild that it's so like demonized in the states too. It's like it wasn't even demonized that way in Canada prior to it being legalized, the same way that it is in the states, which is wild.
The schools in the states, it's crazy. Like they're very fear mongering about it. Like the education I got about it in my health classes and stuff that I took, it was like, I thought I was going to die. Like I was like kind of afraid of cannabis before I started using it.
Yeah. Right.
Like I will say
of
though,
all the like weird messaging that they shove down our throats.
I will say though, like obviously when I first started smoking weed, when I was, I don't know, in my late teens, I thought, like, this is amazing. Like, everybody should do it. It makes me more introspective and more self-aware. And I think I'm a kinder and compassionate person because of it. And I thought it was like the greatest thing ever. But then I had experiences with a few people sort of in my immediate life that had tried smoking weed at a younger age that had like significant psychological effects. Where
predisposition
they
to schizophrenia,
exactly same type of thing. So if you're using or if you're smoking, engaging in using THC under the age of 25, like I think people need to be really careful about that.
Just
a caveat to the conversation we were having before.
Weed will 100%. Turn you into a criminal. Stay away from it, don't touch it.
It's a gateway drug.
It is. And the gates are wide open.
this week, we are throwing to a conversation with Dr. Zach Seidler. And he is all the way from deep down in Australia. And we spoke to him about men's mental health. And he's actually, he plays a big role in taking big leaps in the world of mental health, specifically.
Tremendous leaps.
He works for Movember.
The best leaps.
It's Movember are good friends of ours. They've always been in our corner and we've always been in theirs. And hey, listen, some Movember info, if you're interested, especially after you listen to this conversation, you could go check out their website, Movember.com, for more information on their campaign and what they're up to and how you can get involved. Or you can go to conversation.movember.com for a handy tool to help guide you through how to have tough conversations with a friend who might be struggling. You could do that or listen to our podcast too. Or you can also sign up and donate today to help change the face of men's health. So, that's movember.com or conversation.movember.com. Let's throw to our conversation with Dr. Zach Seidler, and we'll see you on the other side. Uh,
Dr. Zach Seidler, clinical psychologist. Is that correct? Psychologist?
That's right.
Clinical psychologist, researcher, and leading men's mental health expert. Also, the director of mental health training at Movember. Very, very good old friends of ours. They've been hoisting our lazy asses up over the last 5 years and giving us a bit of love every year when it's mustache time. Zach, I'm gonna, you know, I don't know if you know this, but I did go to theater school and studied acting at a very esteemed university here in Canada. And one of the big things that we did was learn accents. But I will save you my Australian accent. I've done it a number of times on the podcast. And if you want to listen to it, you can go back and listen to past episodes. It's dialed in.
Appreciate it.
Cheerio. You know, it's quite, it's quite something else. Zach, let's talk about men's mental health because there's clearly... it's clearly still to this day, you know, since day one, since we started this podcast 5 years ago, mental health has been something that we made a concerted effort to touch on at least once per month on this show. And one of the things that we realized pretty quickly was that when it comes to talking about mental health, especially from a man's perspective, a lot of guys out there have a hard time wrapping their heads around the idea of even going remotely close to that subject. Mm-hmm. And 5 years later, although it seems like there's been, like the needle has moved slightly, it still seems to be quite an issue. And I'm sure that you have some like stats that would prove that to be true. Mm-hmm. So what's it like? What's it like being a clinical psychologist and also working for Movember from a mental health perspective?
Well, firstly, thanks for having me, guys. It's great to be here all the way from the other side of the world, Australia, not New Zealand. But let's get that out. The really important thing, like when it comes to men's mental health, the fact that we're having this conversation and the fact that you guys have this conversation regularly is pretty crazy. You know, like a decade ago, no one, you know, with your hipster good looks is talking about mental health. This doesn't happen. So we've made great, you know, progress in that instance. In saying that, from a stats perspective, we lose a man a minute to suicide the world over. It's about 500,000 men a year. And you know, from anecdotes to personal stories that everyone has, it's not a ripple effect anymore. It's a fucking tidal wave, you know. Everyone has been touched by this stuff. Silence is deadly. And I think that the thing that we're starting to understand is that programs like this are leading to the undercurrent, if you will, shifting. Yeah. So the way that we understand and talk about mental health is making huge progress, and we're starting to understand that we can shift the dialogue about this stuff, but it's going to take a fucking long time, especially, you know, middle-aged guys who are potentially isolated and living in regional areas and all that type of stuff. Ooh. Becomes really difficult over time.
What makes it so hard for guys to like make that first step in, you know, opening up and starting to talk about their mental health? I mean, from my perspective, we've been doing this show for 5 years, and I understand the importance of doing self work, and especially focusing on, you know, for one example, seeing a therapist. And only recently, even after having these conversations, which, you know, kind of have been this form of therapy for me over the past 5 years, only recently, like in the last 4 or 5 months, did I actually start seeing a therapist myself. And so I'm curious, like I'm like ripe to see a therapist because I'm in this environment where I'm talking openly about this stuff quite often. But for guys who, you know, don't have the privilege to be able to have discussions like this, you know, for their job, what is it like, what makes it so hard to take that first step? And like, how do we get more people to do that?
Well, that just shows, and I appreciate, you know, sharing that with me. But I think that what it comes down to is that if someone like you finds this shit hard, you know, and I find it hard as well, talking about my own mental health is a really difficult discussion. And I'm, you know, I'm literally the guy who should be doing this. So the fact that it's hard shows that it takes practice. And sadly, you know, young guys growing up don't get the same practice to deal with vulnerability and emotionality, you know, that women do, for instance. And you look at 12 to 16 year old guys and they're not sitting around talking about what's going on in their head. They just don't do that. Thankfully, you know, football clubs nowadays in Australia are starting to introduce this type of discussion so that they can normalize it, I guess, over time. Mm-hmm. But the reason it's difficult is because it's not something we do very often. We don't necessarily have the language to do it, but I want to stress that we have the capacity to, and it's Ooh. It's really clear. You know, I deal with guys of all shapes and sizes, different age groups, different ethnicities. No one is immune to this stuff, and no one is unable to describe what's going on. They just do it in their own fucking way.
I just want to correct you there. You said football clubs. I think what you meant was soccer clubs. Yes, I fully
we have rugby as well. I'm just throwing it out there.
Fully heard everything else you said there. How much of it from a psychological standpoint, and from, you know, from the work that you do as a professional, how much of that do you think is a generational issue? And to add to that, do you think that like, you know, a child today who in 30 years from now will be like, do you think the landscape is changing that way? Because I hear you say all this stuff and like I look at my dad and I go, he's the fucking pinnacle of the dude who just buries that shit as deep down as he can, you know? And then what happens? Well, you get ulcers and fucking shit festers and it boils up. And then all of a sudden relationships are ending and you're a fucking mess. And I look at myself and I see that and I go, fuck that. There's no fucking way I'm going to go there. But then I look at things that I'm doing, you know, like I have this ability to pull back and I go, yeah, but you're not that much better. You know, you still do this and you do that and you do that. And so like
marginally,
do you think from where you're standing and from the work that you've done, like, do you think it is generational or do you think it is, fuck it, I don't know. Like,
can I take that a step further?
Sure.
And ask if,
and you need to answer all of this. Like, you need to remember all of this. Soundbite. Okay?
Yeah. Keep going, Taylor.
I was going to jump in there, and then you went with that. But I was in the same frame of mind in what I wanted to ask, which was, is there evolutionary markers to like why males are less prone to sharing, opening up, whether there's like competitive aspects to, you know, if you look at like just evolutionary markers, is it just to take it from that generational lens and expand it out even to like our biology and how we're made up.
Cool. Like, all right. Well, I'll start with Jeremy's point, which is the idea, I guess, that over time, hopefully we're breaking down these traditional masculine norms of fucking stoicism, self-reliance, independence, all the things that all of our dads and grandparents, especially, you know, all my grandparents are Holocaust survivors. If they didn't have stoicism and independence and just fucking get on with it, they wouldn't be here. There's no doubt about that. So firstly, there's like benefit to some of these things, but the key, you know, and what I think we're seeing generationally is hopefully flexible masculinity, where you go, all right, I want to be independent. I want to be self-reliant. I kind of want to be a breadwinner, but there is a time and a place for all of this shit. You cannot be rigid, because when you can't live up to it, which none of us can, you get this sense of failure, shame, depression, suicidality. Describe masculinity as hard won and easily lost. This idea that we're continuously striving for something that's unattainable and unnecessary, when in fact your masculinity should look exactly as you fucking want it to. You know, that's within your control. But we are definitely seeing shifts, I guess, in the fact that, you know, young guys understand what mental health is now. We grew up with it. There's been discussions at school. That didn't happen for our dads and grandparents. And so that's huge progress. Whether or not we're going to see a complete eradication of all of these issues and everyone's just going to be dancing around going, look how vulnerable I am, that's not going to happen either, because women don't do that even. So we shouldn't be striving towards that necessarily. What we should do is try to open up the lines of communication and go talk about it in the way that you want, in a way that makes sense to you, that you understand over time, and just tell your kids that you can do this and practice with them. That's really what it comes down to. And so I reckon, Jeremy, in 30 years' time, we're going to see kids hopefully, you know, without the whole social media shit that's, you know, wreaking havoc on the side, hopefully are going to have the verbal communication and the vocabulary to go, this is what I'm feeling and this is what I need to do differently, rather than let me bury this. But Taylor, when it comes to your question, everyone really loves to fall back on the idea that, like, testosterone means that we don't know how to fucking talk. I've seen some incredible studies with, like, four-year-old boys who are sitting in preschool with all the girls and they've been followed from 4 to 6 years old, and they come in at four and they are the most expressive kids. They actually have a wider emotional spectrum than the girls do. Boys have a really wide spectrum of emotions. And then you watch them at the age of 5 and 6 and they're suddenly looking to their parents and looking to the other boys in their class and going, oh, I'm not getting reinforced for crying anymore. Mm. And no one's listening to me. And suddenly I'm being shushed and suddenly the other guys are laughing at me. And it slowly becomes condensed. And the saddest thing that I ever saw was that you actually don't only cut off talking about sadness and talking about, feeling overwhelmed. You get these little kids actually losing joy at the same time. And so you've got this serious cutting off at both ends of the spectrum, because any form of extreme emotion is not something that is condoned, I guess. And that's why we end up with, sadly, anger and aggression being the only thing that bubbles to the surface.
So is it basically like a, like this trajectory that you're talking about that has been seen among young male children? Like it's just through society norms, it has like cultivated this retardation of like emotional intelligence. Like, is that basically what we're looking at? And like one of fucking probably thousands of different reasons why,
for sure,
suicide is like one of the most, or is it not the most, the highest
killer for 15 to 44 year olds? Yeah.
Whoa. That's crazy.
Fucking crazy.
Yeah.
That's a crazy statement.
Well, that's a crazy statement. And you said right from the top, you said you mentioned that one a minute, which is absolutely mind boggling. And then you also said like 10 years ago, this is something that like you're just not hearing about. Like, this is nowhere. Movember hasn't, or maybe I can't.
We're
remember
kickstarting, but we're in the prostate cancer space at the time.
Yeah, not where we are today with Movember. Movember has obviously made massive strides and made a huge impact across the whole globe. But so, where does this work for you come in? How do you get attracted to this work? I mean, I'm assuming you're somewhere in the neighborhood of our age, like the 30-ish range. Where does the inspiration and the motivation come for you to get into this work and look at it specifically?
For sure. So I've got a few, personal reasons that I got into this. I actually lost my dad to suicide 7 years ago, and he was a GP. He was a family physician. Went around and told all of the doctors at conferences to look after themselves, to talk about well-being, and he couldn't do it himself. And I was already studying to be a psychologist at that time, so I don't think that it necessarily, made me who I am today, but it definitely has motivated me. And rather than thankfully, cracking me and stopping me from pursuing this, it's actually, lit a fire in my belly to go, if he, who had everything at his disposal to be able to tackle this thing, still felt such shame and guilt around reaching out. I felt so awkward discussing any of this stuff with him. We knew he was depressed for a really long time, but it was so uncomfortable, and he wanted complete control around that, because it was everything to him. His profession was everything to him. If he couldn't be a doctor, he didn't want to be anything, really. And so that really started my understanding of, like, wait a second, there's something fucked with the system here. Because he went and saw so many psychs, so many psychiatrists. He was in and out of hospital. They knew him, you know, and he was, and the idea that men suicide out of the blue, I just do not buy. Not offering them what they want, what they need. We're going, sit here, sit across from me, and let's talk about things the way that I want as the clinician. That's not how it works. You need to discuss things with guys in a way that makes sense to them and ask them, what do you want from this? How do you want this to work? So that is something that continues to drive me and thankfully, you know, isn't very much in line with Movember's agenda. But really what it comes down to, I've just watched too many of my mates struggle unnecessarily when they could have just earlier reached out before crisis hits and just gone, what's going on? And I watch the way that men interact with women. Gender has always just been intriguing to me. You know, much like Jeremy, I'm a drama boy. I hung out with way more women and I realized, oh, wait, I can talk to them in ways that I can't talk to my male friends. And it's not that I don't have the language. It's that it's just really fucking uncomfortable. And if I go to the movies and I'm watching a Pixar movie, I'm watching fucking Toy Story 3 and I'm bawling my eyes out and my mates are next to me, I'm like doing this. I'm like stopping the tears. I'm like, why is this happening? So I'm always thinking about what is in control of my emotions here and what am I afraid of? And so I just want to break that shit down for good.
I want to touch on one thing that you said there that is like really this idea that a man comes in and you go to talk to him, but you don't want to just talk to him the way that the clinician has been taught to, or the way that the clinician wants to. And you say, well, what do you want to get out of this? What is it that you need to hear? Or what is it that you want? When I hear you say that, I feel like the like 99.9% of the time, the response is going to be, I don't fucking know.
I don't know.
How does one know? If you don't know what you don't even know, how does one know? How does one know what even to think about or to examine or dig into if this is so fucking foreign to you, you know, what is, do you have anything, say someone's listening and they heard you say that and they've heard something like that from their therapist and they really don't know. Like, do you have any sort of,
I'll never start with that. The problem is that as you said, it's so foreign that men aren't like oriented or educated to this type of, you know, communication style. It doesn't make sense. And often I say, you know, we don't need to sit across a chair face to face and talk like this. I've got a pool table at my work. And so we can just play and just chat. And it doesn't need to be like, how are we going to progress here? How are we going to find things? It's like the therapeutic relationship is shown to actually lead to like 33% of positive outcomes. So it's like, do we connect? Do you respect me? Do you trust me? That's going to be like the most important thing. You know, my role as a clinician is to go, what are the practical ways that we can change things in your life to get you towards that? So I guess that's and someone always comes in, you'll always go, I want to drink less, I want to have better relationships, whatever it may be. There's always a target, something wants to change, I'm not sleeping, whatever it is. And we'll always find a way to just try to hit that. And I constantly go, I need you to tell me, is this fucking working? Because this is a two-way street. I've told clients before, right. I'm like, you're just, I always use this metaphor, I'm like, I am the navigator. You're in the driver's seat. You've got access to the accelerator, to the fucking gear stick. You can do whatever you want. And so I'll tell you, here's a quick path. Here's a slow path. Here's this one. Here's that one. And you'll decide if you want to go straight, if you want to go the long way, the short way, or if you want to fucking plow into a tree. Ooh. Because so many men just go, yep, that's what I'm going to do. Or I'm going to reverse. Ooh. I'm shit scared. I'm out of here. And I'm going to call you on that. And we're going to have this discussion and go, this is what you're doing right now. It's up to you, but I'm not here to fuck around.
Hi, I'm Jessie Cruikshank.
Jessie Cruikshank.
I host the number one comedy podcast called Phone a Friend.
Girl. Let's phone a friend.
Not only do I break down the biggest stories in pop culture with guests like Dan Levy and members of NSYNC, I do it with my own personal boy band singing jingles throughout. Because it's my show.
It's your show, girl.
New episodes of Phone a Friend.
Yeah.
Drop Thursdays wherever you get your podcasts.
So work it, girl. Yeah, work it.
Okay, that's enough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I feel like there's like... I don't want to break it down to just like two types of guys, but there's like, certainly there's like a more alpha type guy. And then, I identify with being like a guy that's more connected with my feminine side. Mm-hmm. And for me, permission to go to therapy was more so like embracing my feminine side. Like mm-hmm. one of my criteria for reaching out to a or finding a therapist was they had to have feminine energy. So it didn't have to be a woman. It could have been a man who had more feminine energy. It didn't really matter to me, but it was like, I, you know, you mentioned the being a drama geek as well. Like I always felt more comfortable opening up to my female friends when I was younger about my problems rather than my guy friends, because I wanted to protect the idea of masculinity within myself and like retain like an alpha male status and not seem weak to the guys, but like still be able to talk about my problems to, you know, somebody else.
But what
else.
Is that? So, what is that? Yeah. What does that say if we go, I want to embrace my feminine energy, so I'm going to go to therapy now where the feminine energy exists? That immediately goes, yeah. Men should not fucking be here. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. Or men should resist the feminine energy within inside themselves. And I believe that everybody has a balance of that, whether you're an alpha male or not, there's still
maybe that's just a part of your masculinity though. You know, that's what I mean.
I think it's so. Like, and I think that's fine. You should be able to embrace it, but it seems like almost like in trying to like, to propagate this idea that for men, you know, going to places like therapy is a positive thing. We almost like sort of like try to message it that like, oh, it's okay, alpha male. This is an okay thing for you to do. But like, there's a range of guys who are struggling to deal with their mental health, and they might not be the guys who identify as trying to be the alpha male type, but they still also need to be able to be vulnerable and open about what they're going through.
For sure. So the vast majority of the population are not alpha males. Yeah. There are very few of them. If anything, when I see the alpha male, you start to he's just flexing. It's all good. Yeah. Yeah. Look at that winter body. Sexy ass. the idea that there is an alpha. I sit across from sat across from famous rugby players, you know, who are massive dudes. And if I hadn't been open to the fact that they can have, you know, what we call multiple masculinities, they can have various versions of themselves that fucking shift moment to moment. You can go out and have a beer with your mates at the pub and then come home and watch Mulan with your daughter and cry. You can do whatever you want at any point in time, and it has to be, again, that flexibility. So, you know, we say that everyone is trying to achieve this sense of alpha masculinity, but the vast majority of men don't even believe in it. They just feel the pressure to live up to it. And so if we try to constrict that and go, oh, you fit into this box, I'm going to treat you like this, we really limit the capacity for these guys to actually show their true colors, which is the issue. And really, Brian, the vast majority of guys that we see, no matter what, you know, they look like, have that ability to access their emotions. They just need to be given the words.
I mean, I was just, I'm an alpha. I was just saying, like, you know, for the guys out there that are betas. Yeah.
I mean, when you said earlier about that they're starting to like implement these things in football clubs in Australia, like, what is that? I think about back to like Brian and I were our best friends. We've known each other since we were 10 years old. Mm-hmm. Brian has been a person for me and probably I for him that like we could talk to, and that there was like an open dialogue.
Definitely,
there. And I also had like friends growing up on like high performance hockey teams that we would swap sappy songs with each other about these girls that we were in love
good,
with and talk
good,
about how fucking heart crushed we were. And I'm kind of like recognizing that in retrospect, because I always viewed hockey as like this like overly dominated like alpha persona going on. But I actually had a fairly like healthy healthy relationship with being open in a lot of scenarios there. But what are these, like, I think about it kind of has to start with kids, with young boys at a certain age, like you mentioned, in like when you followed that group of 4 to 6 year olds, you sort of see this emotional contraction happening. Do we need to just go right to the starting point and go, what can we do at this level to stop this emotional contraction so that you then don't see that happening at the adolescent level, and then you see it less into adulthood?
For sure. Because adolescence, you know, around the age of 16 or so, that's a really prime time, definitely, to start to focus, and getting onto them really early is always the key. And I think that, you know, anytime we come to an issue as researchers or clinicians, we go, we need to go earlier. But it's like, we also need to deal with the fact that there are 35 to 80 year olds that are still alive, and we need to like help them as well. So we can't forget about that. We need to do both. I reckon something that's really key here, and that we've all spoken about a bit, is the idea that there are actually really awesome ways for male-to-male dialogue about this stuff. And the idea that it's only men can talk to women, and especially that men can only talk to like female clinicians or whatever it may be, is bullshit, isn't true. It might look different, but we all know that we've got a male friend who we know how to have that connection with, and we need to build those up to make those conversations more meaningful over time. Something that we do at Movember, we've got this awesome, actually a hockey program called Breaking the Ice, which is aptly named. In Australia, it's called Ahead of the Game because it's for rugby and cricket, etc. And in Canada, it's called Breaking the Ice, and it's focused on getting in and building up mental resilience in kids. And so we teach parents, coaches, and kids around how to deal with a loss. You know, what vulnerability in the face of hardship actually looks like, how to overcome that and build up the skills to go, all right, I'm feeling like shit. What do I need to do? Who do I need to rely on? Who can I call? That type of thing. Because we know that especially in the elite sports, mental health issues are like through the roof because the pressure is immense. And fundamentally, if you look across the most successful teams in the world, you know, there's so many fucking Netflix documentaries now about this. The ones who have these like vulnerability. They get someone to get up and talk about an issue that's going on for them. And they're just these big blokes just crying. And it's like, oh, how are they winning trophies? I remember because they fucking love each other. That's what's going on. Yeah. And they rely on each other and they understand what's going on. Lying, you know, keeping everything to yourself, being ashamed of the truth of your humanity doesn't benefit anyone. So that's what the Breaking the Ice program is trying to get, you know, adolescent boys to go, this is in my best interest for my performance, for my schooling, for everything, because boys are just doing worse across the spectrum. You know, we do worse at school. We die 4 years to 6 years earlier than women. We just, you know, we're not thriving in the way that we should be. And that's because everything is constricting, as you said.
Yeah, I mean with sports, I mean if you are, like you said, it's such a pressure cooker environment anyway at the highest levels. And then but at the same time, all these people are also living a life outside of that sport. They've got problems, yeah. They've got issues, they've got relationships, and there are things that come up. And if you can't unburden yourself or feel like you have a space or people to unburden yourself with, especially the people that you are probably closest with, i.e. teammates, people that you spend all of your time with. I mean, again, just adding to that, like about to crack.
It's torture.
I mean, it's amazing to hear that there is that. That's a really cool little program that you mentioned there, that they've got a vulnerability room. They come in, they take that time, get it off your chest, talk to people, be open. It's really cool.
But is it like as simple as, like, we talk about the word vulnerability a lot, and like that's probably the most important takeaway I've had from the last 5 years of doing this podcast. But like, is it that simple? Vulnerability, being open and talking about what you're going through?
No,
I feel like it's not.
No, and right. Taylor, if you think about the amount of pressure that these guys are going through, you look at the substance abuse issues, you know, in the sporting world. It's like, why are they drinking and drug taking? And then you've got domestic violence. All of this is tied up with, fuck, I cannot be the person that I want to be. And now I just need to, you know, slowly and surely just explode, you know, one way or another. And that's what happens. It's like a self-destructive pattern. But Brian, if we're going to think about vulnerability being the key here, no, I don't buy that for a second. I think it's a start, and it's a communication toolkit to go, all right, what type of setting am I in now? Who am I? Support people. What can I do to reach out to them? And really, you know that, you know, therapy is not purely about just going, oh, here's the issue. You can't just go, here's my vulnerability, now I'm fixed. It doesn't work like that. And so it's like the way that I always stress it is like, you're not coming in here to get over anxiety or depression or whatever is going on for you. I'm going to help you live with it. And that's really what it's about. And so it's a matter of going, here's my vulnerability. That is the first step. Because if I don't know what's going on, if I don't know that you're down in the dumps or suicidal, whatever it may be, I can't even begin to access, you know, your emotional life. And so we get there, and that's the first step. But there's a shit ton to be done after that, which is really focused on, like, how can we shift your habits? How can we focus on your relationships and what needs to happen? And it's hard yards. There's no doubt about it. There's no magic pill here for this stuff, but damn, it's worth it.
I feel like that gives me a lot of clarity around that, because like I've always thought of like vulnerability is the key. And now the way that you frame it, it's like the key first step
to open the door that leads you into a fucking maze.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But you got to get there.
It's like the key there is the management, right? Like the idea that maybe this isn't something that you just that you talk about and it goes away, that you bring it up and then you fix it, but something that rather you learn how to manage and live with, because I when you're going back and correct me if I'm wrong to say this, but when you look at suicides, it's like it's a lack of it's an inability to manage and a lack, like you mentioned, in the system to provide the tools with which to manage. So I mean, that's like that's a huge aspect.
Well, the way that I shift it really often is, I saw a client yesterday and he goes, I'm feeling the best I've ever felt, and this is I'm so much better than I was before. And I'm like, all right, we've got better and worse now is this dichotomy. If you say that you're better, then that implies that you can be worse, rather than I'm just learning. I'm fucking learning, and I'm gonna gain skills over time. There's no right or wrong here.
That's the best and worst thing about therapy. I have a problem with validation, and like so I say something to my therapist and I feel really good about it, and I'm like looking for that validation in the thing that I said, and then I don't get it. I'm like, what the fuck? You know, validation's an issue for me. Like, give
why
me
do you
some
think I trained
that
for 10 years? I'm like, nah, you're not having it.
Brian, I just want to say, Brian, you're doing really good today.
You're doing so well.
Thanks,
that hat looks incredible, man.
Brian,
are you wearing your Invisalign consistently? Because I can see some changes there.
I just took them out now, but just for this recording. But yes, thank you so much.
Oh fuck.
I have a partner,
Zach.
I'm okay.
Zach, I want to ask what your thoughts are on the, and maybe we're opening a huge can of worms here, but I want to know your thoughts on the term toxic masculinity. And you know, like, is that a useful term? Is that a problematic term? Is it something that's become, is it something that had good intentions but then became something somewhat of a problem? What are your thoughts on that?
Awesome. Great question. Can of worms. Here we go. So I don't buy it at all. It's, you know, as a scientist, you know, who tries to measure masculinity all the time, I don't use that term. I talk about like rigid or harmful masculine norms, which is the idea that, like, as we've discussed before, if you go out and you're misogynistic and you have, you know, seek power over women and you are homophobic and all of these horrible things which have now been tied up with masculinity, those are really, really harmful for your own well-being and the well-being of humanity. But what it comes down to is that, as I've said, the vast majority of masculine norms are going to be really fucking useful in some settings. If you're a firefighter, if you're not stoic as shit when you run into a fire, you're not going to be able to last. But what we want is that when you come out, you cry your eyes out, you tell them about the cat that died in there, you deal with the trauma, and then you get ready for the next fire. And that's the way to do it, rather than coming out. And it's a metaphor. The fires is putting out fires constantly. And that's what men need to be better at, rather than I went in, I'm fine, I'm sweet, let's go to the next one. That is, you're going to break down naturally. So toxic masculinity doesn't allow for us to have that conversation about what is useful and what is harmful. It immediately goes, you know, masculinity is bad for you. And what that does, as we've seen, is isolate and alienate a huge amount of guys that we really want to access and engage. And many of them are fucking assholes. I'm not going to deny it. I've been on Twitter. Yeah. I get death threats all the time. I'm like, what are you doing? We're all striving for the same thing here. But if I don't empathize with their situation and I immediately demonize them as a clinician, I'll never see them. And if I don't see them, then we end up with a pretty problematic situation where the lives that we're trying to save, we're actually pushing them further away. So we have to find a way to engage with these guys, call out their bad behavior while also going, what can we do differently here? So toxic masculinity potentially closes down the conversation.
When I something that I was thinking, because I was listening to a podcast just the other day, and this was a topic of conversation, toxic masculinity, the idea of toxic masculinity.
I only listen to this podcast and stuff.
so do I just re-listen to my own voice over and over again. And it was me that was talking about it. and something that I see a lot in a lot of men, and that I certainly saw in myself in my teenage years and definitely in my late teenage years, is that this idea of putting this like term of toxic masculinity, like it's like when you are trying to attain a version of masculinity that isn't authentic to you, that's bad. Or because I felt like that was, because like you said, masculinity is flexible. It's different depending on who you're with, what your situation is, what the context of your environment is. And you can be flexible and move through different aspects of masculinity all the time. And I found that I spent a lot of time as an adolescent trying to be a version of masculine that I thought somebody else wanted me to be.
It's not you, though.
And yeah, exactly. And I was wearing the mask and all that metaphorical stuff. And, you know, taking the mask off, you start to see like, wow, that was, I was an actor.
Can't breathe. I cannot breathe.
Yeah. And it is smothering. Exactly. Cannot breathe is a great way to put it. Like how do you, cause I just happened to come to it by like dumb luck, fell on my ass into a life where my mom got hardcore into yoga in my teens. I ended up picking that up. That's where Jeremy and I ended up meeting. Brian got into yoga. Like it was just it just happened that I was all of a sudden open to hearing somebody tell me that I was being inauthentic to myself and decided to make a change, but not everybody gets that kick in the ass or whatever it is. Like how do we change that conversation in terms of like letting people know that you don't have to be the version of you that somebody else wants.
And to piggyback on that, Tay, like I think how can men support men, even though out of the hundreds of thousands of downloads that this podcast gets every month, and there's only like 10 other guys that listen to this fucking show. For the 10 guys that are listening,
go,
guys that are listening, how can men support other men? How can men be there to like open that up, like what Tay went through?
Love it. So what we've taken away is that yoga equals flexible masculinity. That's what we're taking.
Right. It's true. Yeah.
Soundbite.
We're going to go beyond. We're going to go beyond the physical flexibility to the mental flexibility. But you know, you say that's by chance, but you are ready, because I can sit down with anyone and I can be like, oh, this is not useful for you, and they can be like, fuck off, yeah, because they're not at the point where they're able to understand what is happening to them in many ways, and so. There were so many ingredients that led you there, and thankfully that worked out. But as Jeremy says, I reckon this is a this is a male mentorship situation and role model. Like, look at the news. Who are you seeing that is like a positive male role model? We got like Joe Rogan and Jordan Peterson who were just spewing garbage left, right, and center. And it's like every young guy.
You've got The Rock. I've thought about The Rock. I actually have thought about him like five times during this conversation in my head going, what a fucking great role model.
He's
what a
jacked
great example.
And he's crying and he's got his daughter on his lap and it's just like beautiful. It's everything that you could ask for. It's like that is what masculinity should be. And so we need more role models like that. And we also need men to be willing to push past that discomfort and that awkwardness to just go, hey, man, this doesn't seem like it's the best way of working. What's happening right now is like masculinity means being your best self. It's self-betterment. It's striving to be, you know, better. You know, it's striving to learn and grow and adapt and get stronger. And, you know, denying the legitimacy and the reality of your situation and who you really are, that's not brave. That's not courageous. That's just sticking your head in the sand. And so having those conversations and, you know, in Movember, we've actually created a conversation starter where we give you the words really to have these chats with mates in your life. It's called Movember Conversations. And it really goes to pushing through that discomfort and saying to the guys in your life, hey man, something's up. I've noticed what's going on. And how can we discuss this in a way that makes sense to you, in a way that's going to break that down? But as we've discussed, there's a time and a place for this stuff. We can't you can't suggest that, oh, he's being stubborn and he's not willing to have this conversation right now when there's 15 people around at a party. It's like, pick your time and place, go for a coffee, go for a beer one-on-one, but call them out and realize that it's kind of in your best interests and in their best interest to do that. And being patient, I guess, with this stuff, because as we discussed, there is so many ingredients that add up to the moment where they just go, I don't want to do this anymore. And we need to have heaps of role models. We need to go to, you know, fathering camps as well, so that we can make sure that we're the positive role models for our kids. And all that takes is going, getting your boy, sitting him down and going, I'm going through this right now, and being human with him rather than attempting to be Superman, because every dad wants to be Superman for their kid. And then you get to fucking 30 and Jeremy's looking at his dad being like, oh, that's not how I want to be. That doesn't work.
Yeah.
But when you're a kid, you're like, look, he never cries. He never does anything. That's awesome. How good. Yeah. And then you realize, oh, and now I have feelings. I don't know what to do with them. We need to upskill the shit out of every guy out there. That's what needs to happen.
Mm-hmm. Man, what I really want to know is, how does Movember always just attract the greatest guys ever to work for?
I know. Talk about role models, you know, like talking to you, Zach, our friend Mitch, you know, like Jesse, like all of the guys that we've met, our fucking manager, Jeff, like every male that I've met who has been a part of that organization in some way has been one of the greatest role models I've come across, period, in my entire life. Like, you're so right about that.
And it's probably not Movember that attracts those people. It's those people that make Movember what it is.
I appreciate that.
I mean, there seems to be so much buy-in from everybody at Movember. Like, you know, which makes sense. There's a cause, and then there's a lot of people that have, like yourself, Zach, who have been, you know, personally affected by, like, you know, in a really big way by a lot of the messaging that Movember's putting out there and the things that they're trying to work on. And and, you know, I think that attracts a ton of authenticity, which makes for a lot of success and great conversation.
It's beautiful working for a charity that's also a cult. You know, it's just, it's a facial hair cult. I don't own my face. In 2 weeks' time, I don't own my face. Like, my CEO has full control of my facial hair, which is hilarious. But I fucking love this stuff, man. It's having these conversations is like the most enriching thing that you can possibly do. And walking around and having events, virtual events, left, right, and center now, where I get to talk about things that matter. And get to, you know, chat with guys like you, and we can see the potential for change. That's everything, you know. And the moustache is just the beginning, really. We've funded over like 1,000 programs. We've raised $1 billion Australian, and it just started with a couple guys in a pub being like, we should bring back the moustache. So there's a lot to be said for manpower in shifting the game and realizing that Movember's been apolitical. You know, we don't get into the gender relations stuff. We don't fight about that shit. It's not necessary. We are just going to help men live happier, healthier lives. And it seems like a pretty easy task. There's a lot of difficulty underneath it, but the messaging is real fucking simple, which is just like, let's talk. Let's get this ball rolling. And I'm very lucky to work with, you know, the best people in the world. And you know, the Canadian team is just out of control.
Dr. Zach Seidler, dude, it's been a fucking honor and pleasure to meet you, and so glad to have you on the show to talk about this stuff, because it's really important. And again, to those 10 males that have been listening to the podcast, we love you, and we're here for you. If you ever want to reach out, hit us up. Zach, I have a feeling this won't be the last time that we'll have you on the show, so I look forward to the next time we get to cross paths.
Thanks, boys. Can't wait.
There we go. That was our little chit chat. And hey, oh, you know, fuck, I forgot to say it beforehand. God damn it. Our audio with Zach was all fucky. And so there were like moments where his track just dropped out completely. So if you were listening to that conversation and you were like, oh, that was a weird moment where Zach went from one thought to something completely different. That's our bad, and my bad, because I'm the one who edited his audio. So I tried my best, but I think, you know, I just tried to make him not sound like a complete fucking psychopath. And I think I did an RH up.
I mean, that's all you can ask for.
Hey, to be fair, after we finished recording that episode, we had problems exporting the track, and there was a good chunk of time where we thought we had totally lost that conversation.
Yeah, we thought we'd lost it. Yeah.
The fact that it's we're able to share with people, even if Zach sounded like a little bit psychotic throughout that that conversation, I'm really happy that we got to share that with people.
Yeah. Hey, and ultimately, we will undoubtedly have issues uploading this track to the airwaves for you to hear it. So, like, you should just be fucking thankful that you heard it at all.
That's right. And if you enjoyed that and want some more of that, go follow us on Instagram or Twitter or Facebook at Sick Boy Podcast is our handle. We are constantly putting fun stuff up there for you to kind of follow along with what we're up to. That's
all that Jeremy has to say. Well, and you know, that sweet little story that we heard earlier on in the episode that came to us via letters at sickboypodcast.com. So if you've got a fun little story that you want to share with us about whether it's something we talked about on the show, your own personal experience with illness, something that just you love about the healthcare system, something that you hate about the healthcare system, could be anything under the sun. Let us know. Letters at sickboypodcast.com. If you've got comments or you've got like grievances, like you want to talk about how frustrated you are with Brian's participation in the podcast, then you can go to sickboypodcast.com/contact. And you do the same thing if you want to apply to be on the show. sickboypodcast.com/contact. Subject: Brian is driving me crazy.
If you feel that way, I'm incredibly sorry. And as I am probably the only one in this group with emotions and take things really personally, I really, really, really genuinely am sorry.
It's fine.
But you can definitely let me know if I upset you.
Nope.
If we're lucky, maybe Jeremy, who edits these episodes, Jeremy Saunders, maybe he'll take this part out, but I assume he probably won't, because he probably just doesn't want to.
too much work.
Unfortunately for you guys, this show is co-produced by me. I'm one of the co-producers, along with Lauren Sankey, Taylor McGilvery, and of course Jeremy Saunders. And our manager who lets me still be a part of the group, even though he probably shouldn't, is Jeff Lonis. And so I'm thankful for him. You're probably not at this point. And the theme music for today's episode was by Rich O'Coin, which is why we can't share these videos on YouTube, because we like apparently don't have the copyright license use for these files. But anyway,
it's because Rich's music is so awesome. They're like, there's no way you could possibly have the rights to use this.
I'm really sorry to CBC as well, but I'm sorry that this is the type of content that we're producing for you.
That is it for this week.
I'm Brian.
I'm Taylor.
I'm Lauren.
I'm Jeremy, and this is Sick Boy.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.